All right, we're going to start in chapter 12, verse 20. Of course, we're looking at the last days of Jesus' life for the rest of John here. So we go. John takes a great deal of his book, almost half of it, in the last few days of Jesus' life, a week or so. And he has already come into Jerusalem, so we know that's where he is. The triumphal entry takes place. It's recorded from verse 12. And then we start at verse 20. I'll just read this. It's just this short section. We'll start with through verse 26. It says, "Now among those who went up to worship at the feast were some Greeks. So these came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and asked him, 'Sir, we wish to see Jesus.' Philip went and told Andrew. Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. And Jesus answered them, 'The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Whoever loves his life loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me, and where I am, there will be my servant also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him.'" Okay, so who enters the scene? From Greeks, right? Some Gentiles. Why is that significant? We have talked about this, so, but within the context of this scene, why is that important?
Nick? So, they're, I assume, Greek Jews. They're just not Judean Jews. So, it's unlikely that they would have any interest in Jesus if they weren't worshippers of Jehovah.
Often called Hellenistic Jews. Yeah. Greeks can also refer to Gentiles, but they're probably, you're probably correct about what I'm talking about. And so, what's one point that John makes throughout, at least lately, at least from chapter 10? What is his, at least one of his kind of overall themes in the book of John that he wants us to gather? If you can get what I'm asking.
Everyone. The one flock principle.
Yeah, the one flock point. Chapter 10, verse 16. He has sheep who are not of this fold, for example. God so loved Jews that he... God so loved the world. Gave his only begotten son. So, that's as significant as we see any kind of new kind of category of person introduced, or anyone who believes that maybe we don't expect them to believe. There were some of the leaders believed, some of even the Pharisees believed at times. Those are all kind of going to that same theme, that this, the gospel's for everyone, everyone's accepted if they believe. Which is good news for us, because we're not Hellenistic Jews, we're not Jews, we're just whatever we are. Right? We're from all over the world. Probably everyone from this room, you're like, your ancestors, somebody probably. Anybody Native American here?
Thought so for 44 years.
I'm told I am. Sort of. Like 1/16th or something. Okay, what hour is the... What is the hour for the sun to be glorified? What is that?
I'm sorry, can I say, make a comment on the Greek still?
Sure.
Hellenistic Jews. I just find it fascinating, because the Greeks were, if it's Hellenistic Jews, but with the Greek kind of teaching, they were very interested in philosophy and in studying and in learning. They were ahead of their time in medicine. The medical field really started in Greece, or among the Greeks. Their understanding surpassed that of other nations, the best that we can tell. I mean, the father of medicine, Galen, he came later, but he was a Greek. And they're hearing what Jesus is doing, and he's raised a man from the dead. It seems natural to me that they would want to learn more about this man, Jesus. Mm-hmm. And Lazarus is, I mean, he's preaching the gospel just by sitting there breathing.
Right.
It seems like they'd be very fascinated with that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Good information. Good point. It also goes, they were kind of, And to the Logos, too, right? The Logos, that was a big thing with them. And that's how John introduces the book. Remember, it's AD 90 or so people reading this. It's not like the same time Jesus is. So he's got his audience there, people a little bit more like us than maybe some of the Gospels that were addressed specifically to Jews. Yeah, good point. Yes?
I just think it's odd. John tells us Philip, who was from Bethsaida. And I guess, rather than the Bethsaida, his name is Philip. That's like a Greek name if there ever was one, right? So I think that Philip must be like, I don't know, the way he dresses or his haircut. They're like, you're a Hellenistic Jew too. So they are at least culturally related to them. Maybe that's what it's about. But it's just strange that he says he's from Bethsaida.
Yeah, just and Galilee to make sure they're got that right too, right? The Galileans were not the cool guys.
Well, and you ask the question, what does it mean to us? It's right, and it, I was just going to say what it meant to them is huge because I mean even as God fears, they were a different worshiping situation than the Jews there. They had different parts of the temple grounds they could go and couldn't pass where other Jews could, and so this whole idea of you get to come and. It's not, that concept isn't here, but it's going to develop that, hey, we're all one flock, and by the way, we're all going to be in the temple together is huge to us today.
Yeah, of course.
Because for them, it was like there was limits on what they could do or where they could go,
I think.
They even had signs in the temple grounds that said,
The court of the Gentiles, we take that for granted, of course, because we, here we are, you know, we... But when you stop and kind of put it in to big picture perspective, you've got a little tiny place in the world where all this took place. Very tiny, insignificant place in the big scheme of things. And then here we are in Folsom, California, gleaning the benefits from all of that. And that's pretty amazing. Lisa?
Do you think that these Jews had ever seen Jesus before?
These guys in verse 20, it said, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Yeah. So I don't know.
Maybe from afar.
I don't know. It doesn't tell exactly where they came from, does it? It just says there were some Greeks that went up to worship, so they were up there for that purpose. But we don't know exactly where they came from. But I don't know. It's a good question. I do. I was going to say though, you know that. That little statement, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus," is pretty, I don't know, I like it. When I went, first time I got up to preach at Fairview and Garden Grove many years ago, Floyd Thompson, who's kind of the legend in California as far as the preachers go, not that's what people thought of him, but I'm just saying, he's a long-time preacher there, 35, 40 years at that. And he put a little sign up there. So anybody who went up to preach at Folsom, the first thing they saw was, "Sirs, we wish to see Jesus." And that was to take the mind off, you know, ourselves and make sure that we were focusing on Jesus when we preach. So that's pretty interesting, pretty cool. I think we had it up here for a while. I don't know, because I put it up there. I followed and imitated him.
Well, the "sir" just shows the respect.
Yeah, well, early.
And so that's why I feel like maybe they've seen him.
Maybe, or
heard of it. I don't know.
Maybe, as your husband said, they're just curious because they there's a lot of this and all this. And so, okay, we want to see this person. There's probably a lot of that going on. I mean, for good purposes or bad, right?
For curiosity's sake, it reminds me a whole lot of the story of Zacchaeus. He wanted to see Jesus, mm-hmm. too. He climbed the sycamore tree to do that, right? But he was curious, wanted to see what was going on, and that turned out well for him.
Again, like you said, this is a small area. There's a lot of... even Agrippa later on, he said, stuff didn't happen in a corner. I mean, you know. Agrippa knew. He was not interested in it from a standpoint of it being converted or anything, mm-hmm. or even trying to believe. But he was certainly knew about it. So, I mean, this wasn't hard to know. These things that actually goes to, the other theme, the main theme of John, about belief. I mean, these things happened. People saw them. They couldn't miss them. And so they couldn't claim, "Well, I didn't know. I had no," you know, they couldn't make that claim.
Amen. It seems like this is the sort of the evidence to support the Pharisees' claim back in verse 19 that the world has gone after him, and then mm-hmm. look, lo and behold, some people not from Judea, the world has shown up also.
Right. It's sort of like, you know, Caiaphas back in chapter 11 when he makes this prophecy. We talked about this at some length. He makes his prophecies. He didn't say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he said. And so he says these things that he didn't even know he was saying, right? And John here, he's recording these words. The world has gone after him. Well, go back to chapter 3:16, right? God so loved the world. It's exactly who he wanted to. God wanted to go after him as the world. That's what he was aiming for. So, out of their own mouths, Allison, I get this. Thank you for helping.
And I don't know how to interpret that. As far as, do they just want to lay their eyes on him, or like, you know, you say like, well, I think you need to see a doctor, or I think you need to see a lawyer about that, or whatever. You know, like, yeah. Do they want to talk to him, or do they just want to see him? But then, so that's just a side comment. But do they? I don't know. That's my question.
I don't know.
Like, are they the crowd that's down in the next section?
Could be. If they wanted to see Jesus, I'm sure they got to some level. But we don't know any more about John. Have you noticed that John does this kind of stuff?
Yeah.
That leaves you hanging a lot. You like throw stuff in there and then kind of moves on.
And I'm like, is it John or Jesus leaving me hanging?
Well, you know? Jesus does that too.
His answers sometimes I'm like,
I know.
Is that a response?
His answers don't address the question.
Yeah.
Or the issue. And we see that. That's sort of like Job, right? When you read the book of Job, he has all those questions, and he gets to the end and says, "Who are you that questioned me?" So, yeah, I don't know. Somebody have a thought? Ben, you thought about it?
I don't know if it's going to add to it, because it is not a definitive answer. But the verses before, it's kind of confusing, because there is a couple different crowds. I think we talked about that briefly. Verse 17, the crowd that had been with him when he called Lazarus out of the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to bear witness. Then verse 18, the reason why the crowd went up to meet him was they had heard he had done this sign. So right there's two different crowds. Then verse 20, now among those who went up to worship him at the feast were some Greeks. So the Greeks could be just people who went up to worship and weren't in these two crowds, or you have these two crowds. There's a lot of people, is my point I was going to make. 2.5 million people, as I said, Josephus, when he wrote, when he was there at that time, 2.5 million people were in Jerusalem. So there's just a lot of people. So I don't know if it's easy to say. But obviously there was a lot of buzz around this Jesus. I mean, we have two different crowds. One who bears witness because he saw the Lazarus sign, and the others who have heard about it and want to come meet him. So
Right. Obviously
it wasn't, well, obviously is the wrong term. The best I can come to the conclusion is that the buzz of all this Jesus, of what he's been doing, is drawing people to him, these Greeks included, is what I'm thinking. I mean, even the way it's recorded, the way they didn't even just go stumble up and say, "Hey, we're going to meet you, Jesus." They went to his disciples to ask. So there is even some respect in the way they wanted to approach Jesus. They checked with Philip, and then Philip and Andrew went to Jesus. So there was a buzz going on about what he'd been doing. That's my long answer.
Okay. Think about what Ben just said. Now, if this is our 2-year John class, we would go up and sketch out all the different.
I know that's why I.
I appreciate what you said. That you just kind of summed it up.
Yeah.
But if we were really going to go in depth, we could get all the different, the crowd here, the Pharisees here, and then there's subsets of all those, right? There's the people and the subsets of the Jews. The Jews sometimes is a very pejorative term used, and sometimes it's it's good. Sometimes they believe, sometimes they don't. You have all those things, but
don't you think that that's part of why he says the time has come?
Yeah, well, I was going to say,
verse 30. Is timing important?
Yeah. Verse 32.
We always say that. Timing is everything.
Timing is everything.
The time has come, and it's
right.
This confluence of all these different people.
Exactly. That's verse 32. It's very telling in light of that comment, of those two comments. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. So the drawing power is Jesus. The drawing power for the Greeks, for whatever reason, was Jesus. That's the whole point of this. He is the drawing power. A lot of churches need to read that and take that in, because they use every other kind of thing to try to draw people, and it comes back to the same point. The drawing power is Jesus. Jesus said it himself. I will draw when I'm lifted up, of course, he's talking about his crucifixion. It says that in the next verse. When I'm lifted up, I will draw all of you. That's going to be the... And if you're not drawn by the lifting up of Jesus, you're not drawn to Jesus, right? We all agree with that. You're drawn by the fact that he was lifted up. Right?
So, I don't think they met with Jesus, and I think his response is kind of saying, time is short, and a lot of things are happening, and what matters now is the people who are actually going to serve me and follow me, right? In verse 26, if anyone serves me, mm-hmm. must follow me, and where I am, there will my servant be also. It's not like he says, yeah, we're going here for dinner tonight.
No.
Right. He's saying, you got to serve me, you got to follow me, and you'll be with me in some sense. I mean, he knows he's going to die, but they don't know that. So, I don't know, I'm starting to think that, sir, we wish to see Jesus is like not meeting the bar, right? And in fact, he's saying, I need people who are going to be devoted followers because this is, it's happening, right? And they're going to be scattered, and there's going to be chaos, and there's going to be people are going to be really upset. And so... yeah, I mean, I think the context, again, of it being, you know, crowded and stressy and lots of buzz in the air, people wanting to kill him, and I think all that needs to be taken into account.
Yeah, we don't really know completely. But,
We don't, and it doesn't tell us, and it so therefore it probably isn't something we should necessarily dwell on, but there's an alternative to that, and it doesn't say... Philip said, okay, stay here, let me go check. And crowds are generally the kind of people that go, okay, so they follow if they're interested in doing. I kind of was thinking maybe they kind of followed Philip when he went to, and then went to, and so then Jesus is saying this, and they're standing there because they didn't just sit still and go, okay, yeah, we'll wait for you to come back and let us know what Jesus says. So, I mean, there's two different ways to look at that, I suppose, but either way, Jesus said what he said.
You can question everything. Maybe one of the more important points here is that Andrew didn't go get Peter. Because we see that elsewhere. I'm just kidding about it being important. But that seemed to be, he actually went and told Jesus. Philip went and told Jesus. Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. But yeah, I don't know. I think what Fred was getting to was that... his answer, and you know, this is again, we come back to the same thing. Jesus answered them. Well, what did they even ask? Do you want to go see the Greeks who come back? They're asking about you. Apparently, that's obviously the context. They said, go, sirs, we wish to see Jesus. So they went and got, and they went to Jesus. So I assume they mentioned that they had some people wanted to see him. Whether he did or not, we don't know. But he says, he launches into this analogy about the wheat falling into the earth. What's that all about? That's the question number three there. Explain the analogy of the grain of wheat. What's that do? What is that? How does that contribute to this whole theme of believing in Jesus and all that?
Well, I probably shouldn't answer. That's
all right. No. You're the only one who put his hand up.
Sorry.
So.
Well, I'm not going to answer that question. I'm going to say, I like in verse...
Don't you know you have to answer the teacher?
Verse 23, this, maybe you're going to get there, is this concept of glorified. That's what he first says. Right?
Yes.
The hour.
Well, that was number two, right?
We haven't talked about that, and I think that's a great point when we're trying to get to what is John's point he's trying to make. We see that in the last group of verses. They didn't understand Jesus until Jesus was glorified, and then we see this idea of him being glorified, and then later on in the 27 chunk, there's this glorified, this concept of what that means. Uh-huh. It's pretty amazing when that happened.
And what is that? What is that hour that he's going to be glorified? Let's all make sure we're on the same page with this. What is it?
Verse 32.
Okay, yeah, when I'm lifted up, right? When his death, right? That's his glorification is in his death, which we don't see again. This is one of those cases where we read this and we say, okay. I mean, I don't know if maybe you don't say that. Maybe you say, well, wait, how can death be glorifying? How can a man nailed to a cross and bleeding, beat up, hanging there, executed, be a glorification of that man? That's what he says, though. That's his glorification because he says it. It's not his only one. was not the only one that is to come, but that's where he is, and that's what he's referring to here specifically. Lynn, is that what you...
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
It just seems high. Reading this, because Jesus, he did not answer the question, or he did not respond really how we would expect, or how I might expect that he addresses what Andrew and Philip has just told him. And by this, I gather that perhaps the Greeks were seeking him because of what Jesus had done, and not because of who he is. And that's why they're seeking him for the life and the health, raising the dead, healing everyone.
Right.
But that's what he's done. It's not who he is. Right. He's the Son of God, and he's kind of the life. Because then when it says, if you love, whoever loves his life loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. So it's more than just about Lazarus raising the
dead. Oh, yeah.
It's about him.
About anybody, yeah. You have to die to yourself. It's much what he says in other Gospels about taking up your cross, denying yourself, and following him, and those kinds of things. Sorry, I skipped you, Jeff.
That's all right. I was just going back to your question about the response that he gives and what he means, and I'm not sure if I understand it perfectly, but it seems that this is almost an eighth I am statement. I'm a grain of wheat. I think he's the grain of wheat here in this story, right? Which he does call himself the bread. He used wheat to make bread.
Not only the bread, he's the grain.
Yeah.
He's the bread. I like that.
And maybe he continues to speak or teach parabolically. Now he's got this Hellenistic Jew, this Greek Jew audience here, and maybe he's doing the same thing that he did with his countrymen, which was, there's people that came because they're circus freak curious, and there's people that came because they're genuinely curious in what Jesus has to say, and he teaches this way because that's a way to sift out genuine intellectual curiosity from somebody who just wants to see what everybody's talking about.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that word sifting is going on all the time. That action of sifting is a constant thing. And remember, there's a lot of books that, I mean, I guess you can read kind of piecemeal and get some stuff out of it. This one really pays off if you read this whole book through several times, because what's going to happen in chapter 14? We're talking about knowing Jesus, right? Knowing who he is and all that. What's going to happen notably in chapter 14? Including the person that... one of the people who appears here. Philip, right? What does Philip say? Show us the Father. Show us the Father, it'll be sufficient for us. Verse 8. Lord, show us the Father is enough for us. He's one of the closest disciples of Jesus. He's the one that gets Andrew and then goes to Jesus. He appears in this book maybe a little bit more than he does elsewhere. And Jesus said, have I been with you so long, Philip? You don't know who I am. So, you know, when you think about that, and then we look back over here, and these people seeking him, not knowing who he is, well, there's a nobody, it seems like, in John really gets it. At least for a long time, they don't really get who he is. Why is he writing like that? Why is he recording this story of Jesus in this fashion? What's his point? Why is he showing all these people who keep rejecting him or falling short in their full appreciation of who he is? What's his purpose in doing that, you think?
Yeah. I think it's designed to make us look at ourselves.
What?
And the ethic of heaven is that the God, the Creator, will die so that you can all live.
Right.
That's the moment of glory. And if we are going to embrace the ethic of heaven, and we're going to get up on our cross, then we're going to self-sacrifice on behalf of someone else who doesn't deserve it, that we might help them live. That is our mission too. And that is counter this world's thinking. Mm-hmm. It's counter sometimes to the very fiber of our being. And as we're challenged with this sort of thing, we have to look at ourselves in light of him as well as the response of these other people.
Yeah. Yeah, good. And that's the point of verse 24 to 26, isn't it? Those verses? Because he starts off, he says, unless a grain of wheat. This is very obvious. You can't put a grain on a sidewalk and expect it to grow, right? What happens? It actually has to go into the earth, and what does it do? It dies. And then it bears fruit eventually. That's where that process works. That's God's process, agricultural law, right? Works that way. Okay, then he says, he expands it in verse 25, and I think these words are important. Whoever loves his life. So now he's expanded that. I do think he's talking about Jesus in verse 24. And then whoever, so just what you said. I mean, the fact is, this is what we're all supposed to do. Whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me, and where I am, there will my servant be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. So the honor or glory, if you will come in our serving the Father, not to us, but to the Father. Yeah. Rich?
I think part of what John is trying to do in showing all these people rejecting him is to explain the very real difficulty of how this happened, how you could have someone raise the dead. Right? You heal someone who's been blind their whole life. Someone who's been lame for 38 years. How could that person be killed? And he's explained how the Jewish leaders, because of their power hungriness, they rejected him, and how teaching in parables is important for that and such. But now, especially following on the Pharisees saying the world has gone after him, and they even said earlier, well, the Romans are going to take away our position, right? And so there's the real question of, wait, but there were people other than Jewish leaders who knew about Jesus and what he did. For example, Hellenized Jews. There's way more Hellenized Jews out there in the world than Judean Jews, right? I mean, these Hellenized Jews go all over. Paul's going to run into them. And those people could have risen up and made him king, right? The same way these Jewish leaders could have made him king. Same way in the earlier in this chapter, the people in Jerusalem tried to make him king. So I think him being enigmatic here with them, talking in grains of wheat and things like that, is kind of important for our understanding of why it was that the Hellenized Jews didn't just say, like, forget, the Jewish leadership is done. The Hellenized Jews, it's our time now. We're taking over this religion. We're going to make this guy king, and this is a new era or something. And that didn't happen. And especially for the audience in 90 AD, when we're kind of, Jerusalem's destroyed, the view of what Judaism could be or was is more Hellenized, right? And so I think this is an important part in explaining Jesus as the event and Jesus as being killed and not becoming this political figure.
Right. No, good. That was chapter 6 when they tried to make him king. And so that, you know, there was a time when he had opportunity to seize that if he was looking for power for himself, but he, obviously that's not what he wanted. So yeah, good. Anything else in that section?
David.
Yes, Jack.
As you said, there's a ton of stuff here, not surprisingly. And one of the things that I think about sometimes is that we can, rightfully so, be awed by God because of his amazing abilities in so many aspects. But something that occurs to me is there are a few things that we can be like God, and namely in service and in love. We can't, you know, pull wheat from stones and all those kind of things or raise people from the dead. And to Jeff's point, I agree with what he's saying that Jesus is almost saying, I am the grain, but it's interesting that we have this thing that we talk about in Bible class, like Jesus is the bar. How can Jesus be the bar? We can never be Jesus, but we can be the grain also. And to go with that full analogy, you know, if the church is just a pile of grains on a sidewalk, what does that do? But if the church is the grain that dies, in other words, we're serving each other, there's where the fruit is put out. Mm-hmm. And then another part is we've been talking about how there was this difficulty and challenge with the Messiah. And they're thinking about Messiah is the grand guy on the mighty horse and all this. But Jesus is actually, no, he's the humble one on the colt. And he's actually going to die to save the nation, which is just completely, you know, how can that be? And that's something that they're struggling. And it occurred to me that nowadays, I think everyone, and I think it's displayed in some groups, can be like, okay, here's Jesus. Look what Jesus is going to do for my life. In the same way, right? If Jesus was the mighty king, wow, okay, we're going to even rise to more power. We'll get rid of the Romans. We'll this. Or Jesus, we know about the health and wealth gospel and this kind of thing. Or, you know, Jesus can help me from this and this. And I think that's kind of maybe why Jesus responds in his way is he's like, no, it's all about service. You want to see me? Well, be ready to serve.
Exactly. Yeah, very good. Yeah.
Because what was the thing that he had said earlier? I lost it. Sorry. Oh, when he meets Philip, is it Philip when he's like, oh, you believe because I knew that you were under the tree? You're going to see way more things than that. And I think Nathaniel. Okay, so I think that's just the thing that he's trying to wake up. Is everyone is like Terry brought up? Wow, you healed someone from the dead. Wow, you raised. And he's just like, it's so much bigger than that.
Yeah. I think that we have to see the counter. Intuitive stuff, the countercultural stuff that comes out of this, and that's what the world doesn't really want to buy into. They want to, like you said, I think you said it well, that they're looking for what can Jesus do for, what has he done for me lately? You know, what can he do for me? And that's what, so we glorify ourselves. Jesus brings this up back in chapter 8, didn't he? And you seek to glorify yourself. And that's the two things. Do we glorify God or do we glorify ourselves? That's like the setting those side by side. Brady.
So I have a question, but I'm going to kind of present it as a statement, and then you can tell me if I'm wrong. Because I'm having a little trouble with the whole glorification thing, but I think I figured it out. And here's what I'm thinking, is that being glorified or glorification really just means bringing honor to somebody in some way. It doesn't necessarily mean death, burial, and resurrection. However, when he says, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified, it's him saying, these people are coming to me because they're expecting my glorification, but they're expecting it in a temporal fashion, and that's not the way that that's going to happen. Here is how my glorification is going to happen. And then he introduces this concept of glorification for him happening through his death in this instance. Because when we get down into 27, we start talking about glorification again, and it's not exactly the same.
No, right. You take that word and what it means, the honor. It doesn't mean you're all shiny and stuff. I think some people see the glory. You know, you're like he's shining somehow. Or it doesn't mean that. It means bringing honor either to somebody.
So then, in that sense, we can have glory, right? And God can have glory, and that means different things for different entities.
1 Corinthians 6 says that when he talks about all those sins that people commit, he says at the end of that you've been glorified, and he says it in the present tense, so something to deal with. And let me just read this to see if this goes to what you're talking about. This is chapter 17. He says, in his prayer, he says, this is eternal life, that they may know that you, the only true God and Jesus Christ whom you have sent, I glorified you on earth, having accomplished the work that you gave me to do. And now, Father, glorify me in your own presence with the glory that I had with you before the world existed. And he says, I manifested your name to the world, and so on. So there's maybe a couple of ways those, because he's going to have that glory that he had when he was in heaven.
Yeah, so that's going to be a helpful passage, I think, when we move forward into the next little section here after 27, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think your point, if I got it right, was don't put too much baggage on that word glory, in the sense that, or make it mean too many things. It all depends on the context.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes,
that,
I think okay. That's what I'm coming to.
Because he says the hour, verse 23, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. And where is that going to happen? It's going to happen in his death. Right. And then, I mean, all the...
Well, I mean, I know you're wanting to move on, and that works, because here, God says that word glory twice, right?
Yes.
They think it's thunder, but I mean, so this is what it's all about. It is all about glory. If God interrupts all of this, I mean, God has spoken once in John so far, and now he's So, I mean, the glory part is the whole point. And it's like, he says, I'm going to die. And then verse 27, his soul is troubled, right? That thinking about his own death leads to his soul being troubled. And that's when God intervenes and says, you know, I've glorified you, and I'm going to glorify you again, and this is all about the glory.
Right. Just make sure that this isn't the same as the transfiguration glory, right, that we saw, where he's pure white and just standing there for people to see. That's a different kind. That word, same word, is used in a different way. Ben?
You know, I was just going to make the point, because I was going to say the same thing as Ridge. I know you wanted to move on.
I'm not moving anywhere.
We keep saying that because it makes it feel better, right?
Yeah.
I know you want to move on. We keep using this term sift, so I'm going to take it to the next, make it up, and say this is the ultimate sift that's starting to happen here, right? And this whole idea that's being introduced of it remains alone, he's going to be on the cross by himself.
Right.
He has to do this.
Right.
And it's interesting that that's one of the most countercultural part of this whole thing. You know, especially in today's day and age, when we look at the way we are, it's all about group acceptance. And this whole thing is challenging because he's doing what he is saying the group doesn't want to hear. We're getting into that next section, but they're at response to him in verse 34. We have heard from the law that this Christ remains forever. Like, they're just not hearing what he has
to
say.
They're not getting
it. Like what Rich said, they're looking for this.
They're looking for something
else. Something else, and he's trying to tell them, no, this is what I have to do, and I'm going to have to do it by myself. And the ultimate sift's going to happen. There's nobody going to be there but me when it's all done.
And the disciples scattered.
Yeah.
All this. Just keep in mind, I think that's the point. You're all making this a similar point. That is that this regression, if you will, or program, the rejection that's happened. Some of these people we expect to reject Jesus because of the power thing. That we see, we don't expect Caiaphas to accept Jesus or believe in him. He's kind of like the model for those, the poster child of those who don't believe, right? And then everybody kind of falls under that category that have some kind of something to lose if Jesus is real, right? If he's really who he is. But then he's getting into this place where the disciples, remember, Philip asked him, show us the Father after this. Peter cuts off the servant's ear because he doesn't get it. He's trying to defend him with arms, you know, with the sword. Peter denies him. Judas betrays him. Why is all that in there? If this book was written by a bunch of guys trying to prop up something called Christianity, a lot of that stuff wouldn't be in there. You know, they'd all be embracing him, and there'd be maybe they'd be throwing a party. But those things are in there because he's showing us even people closest to Jesus for 3+ years who saw everything he did, heard every word he said, didn't get it. So, who said, "Oh, Jim, you know, what are we supposed to do with that?"
Well, what would you expect? I mean, this is a cross-section of humanity at that time, as it were, narrowed down. What would you expect? The people, and it's all the different reactions to Jesus. It is like today.
Yeah.
You know, you can come to 10 people and only one will really, quote-unquote, you know, get it. The other 9 will just have 1,000 questions.
But right, I agree. My point is, though, who are the disciples right now?
Yeah.
We are. So we look at this and we say, wait. This is, I think, you know, I could argue the whole Bible's written for this purpose, is for us to say, wait, you know, am I seeing this correctly? Am I getting everything I'm supposed to get out of that? It's a lifetime work, right? That's my point. Tim?
Helping you move on to question 4. I think all this touches on why his soul is troubled. It's being God, he knows all these things are going to happen, and so I think he feels that also because he's human. He feels the betrayal of Judas when everyone scatters. He's keenly aware he's going to be separated from God for a period of time. He knows that all these things he's done for everyone, few are actually going to follow him and be saved. He's keenly aware of the physical pain that he's going to go through. And I think I think any of us would just go screaming mad and run off naked into the hills if all of this knowledge fell on us at once. And he knows he has to go through it. And so that soul is troubled. I think when you really stop and think about what is going on in his mind, it's mind-boggling to think that he deals with it, and still he just says, my father's will be done.
Yeah, right. I think that's what he comes to in the garden. And yeah. Do we get it?
This is a side note. I know it's not the point of the passage, but and I don't think this would convince like a non-believer, but for someone who, like me, who has faith already, little things like the fact that something that happened on day four or whatever of creation is now being used as an analogy for Jesus. I mean, it's just like, it just further proves the cohesiveness and that there was a plan before creation even happened. And I mean, just like, you know, the eight people in the ark and them crossing the Red Sea, and that's a type of baptism and all this. So it's like,
No, this, he uses, yeah, he uses that. That's very good. That's a little more than a sight. We got a minute, so let's just make sure that we are drawing from this what we're supposed to. The analogy, I think we brought all this out. Verse 25, whoever loses his life. We see this in every one of the Gospels. All of them have the take up your cross point, right? Take up your cross, deny yourself, follow Jesus. It's, what does that take up your cross mean? It doesn't mean, oh, I'm sick, I'm going to bear my cross. That's not what it means. It means taking up the cross of crucifixion and carrying that around. That's what we carry. I did that some time back. I have that illustration where I had the man carrying his cross and he keeps chopping off a little piece of it because it make it a little bit lighter, you know. And then he gets to this big gap. The cross was supposed to cover that gap. And he could walk across it. He put that cross down. He could get across the gap. But his all the other people are going across. He can't because his cross is too short because he keeps chopping it down a little bit to make his cross a little lighter. And that's the temptation that we have. And clearly, the gospel, all the gospels are written for the purpose of us to learn the importance of taking up the cross. And I think John says it so profoundly here by using the analogy of the grain. And we're supposed to then take up that and do that. And that's kind of where we're supposed to go.